Hello, hello. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. Welcome back. Welcome back. I hope everyone is great. It's been kind of a nutty month for me. Really fun. I got to go to Muse Expo. So if you recall, I got to interview Monty Malone of A&R Worldwide, and he and Sat Bizla put on this music conference called Muse Expo in Los Angeles, and they have music professionals from all over the world and bands from all over the world, and it's just a really incredible experience. A lot of incredible talent, emerging artists that you're going to be hearing from in the next months and years to come. So really exciting. And then I also got to go to ASCAP Expo, met some incredible songwriters, incredible music professionals, some of which I attacked to be on the show, like my guest today, so you'll be hearing more from them. And before we do that, I just want to mention our last podcast episode with Diana LaPointe. She is the director of music licensing at Sony Music, and she just gave a really, really good talk all about her career trajectory from Berklee College of Music, coming out to Los Angeles to work at Warner Music and then Sony, and then talking all about content, about how there's been such an explosion of content, and this content needs music. So all these platforms that, you know, are out now with content that need music, new platforms that are coming out. So if you're looking for a job in music licensing, this is a really, really good podcast to listen to. Or if you're an artist and you want to learn more about these content platforms and how you can get your music license, I think this would be a really, really educational show for you to listen to. So go on back and listen to that. And this week, I welcome Sarah Lieb, who, yes, I did get to meet at ASCAP Expo, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy this interview. She is just a powerhouse. She talks all about her trajectory from Berklee College of Music and New England Conservatory out to USC for jazz. She is an incredible singer. She's performed all over the world and released music, and then she's also a vocal coach and teacher. She's opened her own studio, and she's launched this app called Voxercise, which is incredible. So she's going to talk about that. And again, this is all about like disruption and innovation, and it's just such a great, great, inspiring interview. So before we kick things off, you know I love to start with music, so we're actually going to start with one of Sarah's tracks. You get to hear her gorgeous voice on Secret Love from her album of the same name, Secret Love.
All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be like some dreamers often do. Just
hey, Sarah, welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell me about your childhood. Tell me all about music and what kind of household you grew up in.
So I grew up in a really musical household. Like, nobody in my family was crazy enough to try and make music for a living necessarily, but everybody was musical, and music was, it was just sort of a part of everything. I have this memory when I was really, really little, like my own daughter's age now, she's almost four, of like marching around the living room, like coffee table with little instruments, like just little, whatever, it was like tiny little hand cymbals and going like bang, 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 little flutes or whatever. And so now I try to do the same. My kid is actually more into like dance and visual art than music. But I feel like in any of my travels around the world, I pick up little instruments, little flutes and little percussive instruments and stuff, so that she can come into my teaching studio and we can go like bang, 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 or crash, crash, because I just think that's fun. So that was sort of the attitude of the household I grew up in. You know, I think my mom always says like, I was never really interested in real toys. I would just take like her wooden spoon and bang on pots and pans. And then in our house, it was really, music was valued. In that sense, basically, when I was a kid, by the time I was six, I was taking piano lessons, and my mom, at some point, probably a few years after that, I was whining at the piano and I didn't want to practice. And And she said, Sarah, in this house, you study history and English and science and history, and you study music. And when you leave this house, you don't have to study music, but you do while you're here. And that was sort of, that sort of instilled in me that music is an educational pursuit, not necessarily something everybody has to do for a living, but it's like, it's just a part of what we do as humans. So I really, I mean, at the time I was freaking mad. Can you cuss on this, by the way?
Cause hell yeah.
Okay. Otherwise I'll hold back.
No, no.
I can do it. I have a toddler, but I can throw fucks here and there. So yeah, I was not pleased at age 8 or 9 when I just wanted to go outside and play and still had to practice. But now I sort of hearken back to that like all the time, because I think that, I mean, music is all, you know, gives us all sorts of skills, and it gives us a sense of meaning and what's the word? There's self-discipline, really, I think, is something that, you know, the generation of kids now, at least in LA, where you and I are, it's not always encouraged. I think people sort of like, this is what I want, and then I get it. And it's like, no, you have to work for it. And I think life is like that. So we don't really do kids a service by saying, like, you want this? Here, have it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I also, not like I grew up, I had everything I needed, and luckily, and most things, many things that I wanted growing up, wasn't like I had a kind of childhood that, you know, where I wasn't eating or something. It was quite the opposite. But I think lucky for me, even though we were really sort of fortunate to be kind of upper middle class, my parents saw that I needed that self-discipline, and, you know, maybe it would help me with math or just creative stuff in general. I don't know. It's just kind of what they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it sounds like it really forged a kind of sense of discipline with you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's definitely the thing. And so now I have to instill that into my students.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you were taking piano lessons. Did you take any other instruments or voice lessons or anything like that at a young age?
Yes. Well, I started with piano, and I did that really till I was a teenager. And then I quit, as every teenager wants to do. And I shouldn't have, of course. And I took up guitar, and I sort of played a little guitar. And that was all mostly just by looking at my dad's Beatles books and Bob Dylan books and just figuring out the chord shapes and stuff. So I never actually took guitar lessons. Took some alto sax lessons. And then in high school, yeah, I started taking voice lessons. And when I realized, it was sort of this thing on alto sax. I remember I was trying to play the Pink Panther thing, like, and every time I went to like, I remember just being really frustrated, and I couldn't get it, and I was like fucking around with it, and I took it out of my mouth, and I went, I was like, damn it, it's so much easier to just sing it. Which isn't, I thought it was like, that was totally normal. And apparently it's not the case for everybody. So once I started taking voice lessons, and I got out of high school, and I was in all these choirs and stuff, I was like, oh, wait. And so I sort of found my instrument that way. Voice was the thing that came really easily to me. Obviously then, you know, I think everybody who's sort of musically talented has something that they're good at, and you learn later, like, oh shit, there are people who are better than I am. I have to work at this. But yeah, that was sort of how I found my instrument. I was singing in choirs and in all the high school groups, and yeah, I think my parents were probably just like, we have to put her in some lessons. We can't let her quit the piano like that.
So did you go to college for music?
I did. I went first to Berklee College of Music,
mm-hmm.
And then graduated from my undergrad from New England Conservatory, from their jazz department. Took some time in between, performed, taught, traveled, performed, taught. Travel, lived, and then eventually went to grad school at USC in their jazz department. And I graduated there in 2009. And that's really what gave me a good sense of being a teacher and loving teaching and understanding that I was getting as much meaning from teaching as I was from performing. And that was really a wonderful sort of turning point in my life, because as much as I love performing, I don't love the life of a performer so much. I don't love making very little money. I don't love traveling all the time. I mean, I love traveling for fun, but traveling for work because you have to me, is not, it's not quite what it cracked up to be. So I really love being a teacher, and I really love that I can perform when I want to, as opposed to because I kind of have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been through all sorts of sort of, you know, at some point I was doing a lot more studio work, and some point I was doing much more singing, and now I'm really focused on teaching. Of course, my app, which I know you know about, but that's also sort of an educational tool. So for me, I really get a lot of meaning out of teaching other people and, you know, finding that little sparkle where they're like, oh, I get it.
So can we back up a little bit? I want to ask you about after college and traveling, and you know, I know you kind of got burnt out on it, but can you talk about that experience a little bit? Like, you know, for people that want to go out and sing, like, what was your experience with that?
Well, my experience was that, you know, I sort of got done with school and I was like, okay, hey world. And, you know, Blue Note had Norah Jones in 2002 and I graduated in 2003 from undergrad and was like, okay, I'm going to do this jazzy stuff with a little bit of pop, and like the world didn't care. And that's obviously fine, because Norah had put out this amazing, amazing album. The world went like insane over it. So it sort of both burst my bubble, which I think happens to most music students, but it also lit the fire under my ass, in the sense that I was going to have to make work for myself. You know, there wasn't anybody just who's going to come to me and be like, okay, here's work. You sing, we'll pay you. That's not usually how it works. And I think, yeah, I mean, there was this experience sort of in high school. I didn't really realize it at the time. By the time I was a senior, I was kind of one of the best singers at the high school. So mm-hmm. I went to Berkeley with a little bit of a bigger head, or maybe a little bit of confidence. And of course at Berkeley, everybody's the greatest singer at their school, and you're sort of brought down quite a few levels. And once again, are a, you know, sort of smallish medium fish in a huge pond, and you have to learn again. You're not the shit, and you have to work hard. And then the same thing happens again when you get out of school. You're in the real world, and you're like, oh my goodness, like, this is not a Berklee College of Music world. This is a world full of hundreds of thousands and bajillions of really talented, hardworking, wonderful people. And, you know, people just don't give you stuff. It was also, I entered Berklee in the year of Napster in 1999, so we didn't have any idea what was going around us. You know, we were just, like, singing and learning and, you know, doing ear training, and the rest of the world was going like, we can have free music. Why would we pay for it? Hmm. So I sort of was entering this world that I hadn't realized was a totally changed world. And where I think the idea going in had been like, you know, you learn, you get really good at something, you find a record label, and hopefully they put out your record. That was not the case anymore. It had just sort of started to crumble. And I'm sort of scrappy, so it was sort of okay with me, as disappointing as that was. It was like, I also grew up in LA, where most of the other really musical kids had parents who were in the entertainment industry or musical or musicians themselves. And while my parents are good musicians, they didn't do that for a living. So I sort of always had to knew that I just had to work twice as hard, because nobody was going to hand me a gig, or for that matter, a studio session gig, some, you know, stuff like that. I think I really had to prove myself and kind of just work my ass off to do so. So yeah, when I got out of school, I moved right back to LA, and my parents let me move in with them. They're like, we're not going to give you money, but if you want to live with us, you can. And that was, 2003. And I just started kind of doing everything and anything I could. And what I did actually for the first few years was, I grew up at a Jewish parochial school, so I knew all these Jewish songs. And somebody I'd known from childhood was like, hey, do you want to teach Jewish music at, you know, synagogues all over LA? And I was like, I don't know. And it was paying me like 50, 60 bucks an hour in 2003. And I thought I'd like hit the jackpot. So that's what I did. I went, you know, took my guitar and went around and sang Jewish songs and taught them the words. And I did that really as a bill payer, I think, for years, while I was trying to get other things happening, you know, make my jazz happen, kind of make myself so many people knew in the scene in LA, record music, get into studio stuff. It was sort of, you know, everybody has to have a day job, and I seemed to find something that was really, it was fun because it was musical and it was teaching, and I didn't have to sit at a desk all day because I had had a job when I was in college working at a law firm, and I was so terrible at it and bored. I thought, like, there's just no way. I can't do it. Some people, I think, are totally cool with that, and I just couldn't get it together. It was like getting up early and being there right on time. I was not as organized as I am. Like, that just wasn't the life for me. It was just very clear that I would fail miserably at anything or everything if that's what I was doing. And yeah, that's also not the kind of smart I am. I think a lot of people, it's not to say that I'm not smart, but I would say that my emotional intelligence rules over my, you know, book smartness. So I can read people and get along with people really well and, you know, sort of hang out with anybody, but going through files and trying to remember numbers and things like that was not my strong suit. So finding those little like Jewish music teaching jobs for little kids was kind of the first entree into, oh, I can do something musical and make money at it while still trying to forge my own path and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I like what you're saying. And this is going to sound totally like random, but I remember I was with a girlfriend and we were shopping at Target and none of the clothes at Target fit me. And I was so aggravated, like the tops were too small and then the bottom would be too big. And it was just, I was so frustrated. And she said to me, she's like, your body is just not made for mass produced clothing. And it's like kind of the same thing with you. It was like your mind and your talents weren't made for like, you know, the generic everyday 9-to-5 office job.
Yeah.
You know,
I was miserable. Mm-hmm. That was only one summer I did that, but there was another time kind of later where there were some things I was doing where it was getting up at 7, you know, out the door by 8, getting to a place by 8:30, teaching or singing or whatever. You know, now I have a kid, so I get up early and I have my shit together a lot more. But I remember just like I would take naps in the car between driving from one place to another just because it just wasn't the way that my body worked. I could go to bed at midnight or at like 10 and get up at 6 and feel horrible all day, or go to bed at 1 and get up at 9 and feel fine. Mm-hmm. It's the same amount of sleep. I still can't quite figure it out, but I'm very much like my father that way, and my brother and mother are the opposite. They can get up early or go on very little sleep and function totally normally. And if my dad and I don't get sleep, we're just kind of assholes.
But again, it's like, that's a creative. Like that to me is a creative that you're not defined by, you know, like you're not a farmer.
Yeah, I've always sort of been like that. Like, I don't really like, it's not that I don't like rules. I can work well within rules, but if there doesn't seem to be any reason behind them, and that's really kind of come into my teaching career too, where, you know, when you're teaching outside of my studio, I've taught at, and now am on the faculty of a couple different universities. And I've had these experiences where the department says, you know, this is what we do. And I've gone, well, why? You know, is that based in voice science, or is that based in this is my opinion, or is that based in some book? And because if it's not based in voice science, like there's no reason we should be doing it. Like that's, you know, if it's not an efficient way of teaching someone, or if it doesn't speak to how people learn, because people learn differently, like it's not efficient and we shouldn't be doing it. And I've come up against a little bit of sort of difficulty in that way. And that's kind of when I started my own studio. I choose to work at universities where people really give me a lot of leeway and say, you know, you can teach your style or your methods, rather than this is the thing we're doing and it works for everyone. Just most things don't work for everyone, as I suppose you just pointed out is the case for me.
Right. But I think that's such good self-knowledge, because I think a lot of people spend so much time, like, you know, forcing the square peg into a round hole. And, like, I have to be this way because this is what society or my parents or whatever is dictating. This is how I should be. And especially with creatives, it's like you really... I think that that's doing a great disservice, like you said, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm so, like, just infinitely grateful to have parents who saw kind of who I was and encouraged that. It paid for my whole undergraduate degree. I mean, like, you know, who sends their kid to music school and goes, like, sure, and doesn't say, like, maybe you should get a teaching credential, or maybe you should. My parents were just like, go and kick ass.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me. I'm picturing myself doing that with my kid. And you know, I would, because I had that, but it still would just scare the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. It's scary. But tell me a little bit about grad school. So you kind of were out in the world, and then you decided to go back to school.
Yeah, I had actually wanted to go to grad school right out of undergrad, but... lucky as I was to have parents who paid for my undergraduate degree. I mean, I had scholarship and stuff too, but they sort of didn't put that burden on me because they were able to, which is amazing. And when I was done, they were like, okay, we are too. Oh, you want to go to grad school? Have fun. And I was like, oh yeah. And USC, as expensive as it is now, it was also expensive then. And there's no way. I just don't think, you know, unless you're going to business school or law school or medical school, like, I just don't think it's a great idea to take out hundreds of thousands of dollars or even tens of thousands of dollars in loans. Because the great thing about it being, to me, about being a musician is that you love what you do. The drawback is that most musicians don't make $100,000. So anyway, I was offered a teaching assistantship there and took it. So I taught while I was a student. I taught there, like, undergrads and some non-majors, voice and jazz and was able then to get an education, you know, my master's degree without coming out with a crazy amount of debt. And that was really, I didn't realize at the time how essential it was going to be to who I'd become, kind of as a teacher and as a person. But that gave me the opportunity really to teach at a high university level that I wouldn't have otherwise gotten. So yeah, grad school, it wasn't easy. I had come from schools where people really appreciated singers, and thought of singers as people with voice as an instrument. And in LA, or at least at my grad school, it really was not like that. I think at least in the jazz department, vocalists were sort of looked down upon as not being as good as instrumentalists. There was this whole really weird lack of appreciation for vocalists and what we do that seemed to come kind of from the top down. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying that. At least at the time, that really seemed to be the case. So that kind of toughened me up too. I kind of had to, you know, it was sort of silly to me because they had somebody who was a good improviser and who was a good musician. They weren't using me. So I had to sort of go around and be like, hello, use me. What are you doing? And then from there, at the time, Tierney Sutton, who's this great jazz vocalist, was teaching at USC and got a position at a place in Pasadena called LA College of Music. Well, at the time it was called LAMA, LA Music Academy, now called LA College of Music. And she said that she would take the position if she could take me and another wonderful singer teacher friend of mine named Kathleen Grace, who is now actually on faculty at USC, which is why I think things are probably better there. But so she took us there, and that was a teaching gig for me. I was there for 8 years, and I'm really grateful to her for that. But it was sort of, USC gave me the ability to teach, and then Tierney gave me the opportunity to. So that was sort of the start of my going, oh, I want to teach at the collegiate level, or, you know, at the adult level.
So talk to me about that, about what it means for you. Now you say you're telling me you have your own studio. So can you kind of talk to me about how do you cultivate a good vocalist? What does that mean?
I think that it means a couple things. It means somebody who knows and understands their instrument. I think very often, because we can't see it and we can't, you know, look inside and go like, oh, look, there's this muscle and that muscle and there are these cartilages. Then we have these crazy ideas of how the voice works. People, you know, and a lot of that is a confluence of a lot of things. You know, when you're in junior high school choir and the teacher says, you know, your belly should move out when you breathe. An 11-year-old or a 12-year-old doesn't really understand what that means and often pushes their belly out rather than understanding that it's a function of the diaphragm moving down. And when the diaphragm moving down, the lungs expand and all the other organs move out of the way. And that's why the belly moves, because everything is tightly packed together. And when you've taken air into the lungs, it's moved the organs, it's moved your body, not, hey, stick your belly out. So I have this really strong sense of, let me show you videos, you know, look up. This is an audio interview and not a video one, but you would see behind me in my studio this sort of medical chart of the pharynx and larynx. And I really, in the first lesson, get into that. This is the physiology and this is how it works. Because I think if people don't, you know, they just don't get it. In the same way that, like, if you're a 5-year-old and you're going to take violin lessons, they don't give you a violin. They give you a box with, you know, rubber bands on it saying, this is what is going to be your violin. You have to learn to hold it. You have to understand, you know, how acoustics work and the strings vibrate, whether you pluck them or bow them and all that kind of stuff. So I start with a really kind of just a basic sort of understanding of the physiology of the body, the chords, so that people get that every instrument has a source and has a filter. So, you know, I'll point to the guitar in the studio and go, like, it's the vibration of the string that's the source. The filter is the body of the guitar. So depending on the body of the guitar, it will sound different. And that's the case with source filter for singers too. The source, of course, is the vibration of the vocal cords once air moves through them to set them into vibration as it leaves the body. And the filter is the inside of our head, like all the empty space in our head. And that's why you and I, we have different cords, obviously, but we also have differently shaped inside of our heads. And that's really the thing that makes us sound like us. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think once people have some people come in knowing that, but it's pretty rare. People sort of look like, oh, that's how it works? Whoa. The fact that these little, you know, these little muscles sit horizontally kind of in the middle of our neck, they're like, oh, I never understood that. Just because I think most people don't talk about it. So that's kind of my thing. I had an amazing, amazing pedagogue and teacher once I got to New England Conservatory and some in college. But before that, I wasn't really taught that way. And I'm the kind of person, like, you can't say, like, sing like you're a butterfly. I won't know what that means. It just doesn't resonate with me. You have to say, like, do this exact thing. I mean, I think I'm like that all the time. Like, I'm like that with my relationship with my wife. She says, please take out the trash. I will happily take out the trash. But I might not notice that the trash is piling up. I'll know what to do and I'll do it, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. So what about the whole American Idol, The Voice, like these types of shows or this type of style, I would say, that's so popular and prevalent in pop music of a certain style of singing? What's your take on all that?
I think those shows can be really cool in a lot of ways. And I think that they can also sort of miseducate the public. Mm-hmm. They can be cool in that they're taking music to the forefront of society and saying, like, look, these people like to sing. Isn't it cool? Isn't singing great? Like, don't you want to sing? Let's make it into a competition so you can watch. I mean, it's a spectator sport like sports are. So in that sense, I think it's taken music from this thing that people like wish they could be, or, you know, this intangible thing to, oh, I like to sing, maybe I could do that. The other side of that, I think, can be that I think we as a society get convinced that, you know, the winner of American Idol is the winner of American Idol. There's no, you know, you don't always remember everybody else who was on it. And I think that what that can say is that there's only room for one winner. And in music, you know, it's not like that. If I listen to one R&B singer who I love, I will probably go and listen to 12, 15, 300 others. No, I only like this one singer. That's it. That's all I'm going to listen to. It just doesn't work that way. So I think it's important. I've had several clients who have been on those shows, you know, some who see me like when they're on or when they're auditioning, and some who have been on or been successful on the shows and then and then come to me. And it's just, I think, really important to talk about that our worth can't be tied into whether we win or don't. Mm-hmm. Because you're a worthwhile musician just because you are, rather mm-hmm. than, you know, there's room for so much more than that, that this is a competition. And it's, I love to watch the cooking shows. I'm really into Top Chef. And I sort of think the same thing about that. Like, I would never go on there myself, because what it says is, like, if you win Top Chef, then you're the best chef. Mm-hmm. That's not what it's about. It's about a lot of things. It's about who the judges think is going to be a star. Are you going to sell more? Can you move? I mean, there's so much that goes into that. And I think, you know, whether it's music or Top Chef, like, it's a competition and they're looking for certain things, not necessarily who has the best technique or, you know, who's going to sing something that this songwriter wrote the best. It's just not, it's not necessarily a realistic idea of how the music industry works, but I think it can, you know, there are some really positive, wonderful things about it. I don't knock those shows at all. I just think it's really important for anybody who's deciding, who's on it or wants to go on it, to know that they shouldn't be tying in their own sense of self-worth with whether or not somebody picks them. And I think that's true of anything. Like, you know, if we as musicians get our sense of selves or our self-esteem from whether we have a good show or not, that's not particularly healthy. So if you're if you're working hard and you're practicing all the time, you're probably doing it right. And you can sort of be satisfied with that rather than I made it or I didn't. Like, that's just not, you know, that's not how life is. I had parents who could send me to wonderful music school. That doesn't, you know, there are other musicians in the world who are as good or better than I who didn't have that opportunity. Or privilege, or were privileged in the way that I was. That doesn't make them any less, right? It just means that I was afforded that opportunity. So while I'm highly aware of my privilege, I try not to give that, like, I try just not to tie that into my own self-worth and try, you know, just try to kind of hone that on my own, because that shit ain't easy.
And I think, yeah, those are great points. And I think the other thing is, too, is that, you know, not everyone is meant to sound like Adele. Like, not everyone is going to have this super rich, you know, like, diva-type voice. And I think sometimes that vocalists feel pressured to emulate that because that seems to be what is at the top, you know, like, well, if you want to be Adele, then you have to sound like Adele, et cetera, you know what I mean?
Well, sure, yeah. So I had that thing with Norah Jones, right, in 2003, and now people want to sound like Adele. I mean, Adele doesn't even want to sound like Adele now. So I think it's true that we really imitate people a lot, and the difficulty there, and this is sort of what I spend like 90% of my time fighting against as a teacher, is that what we're used to hearing on the radio is somebody singing really high in their chest register, often uncomfortably high. And you can do that 1, 2, 5 times in the studio and probably not damage yourself, at least not for the long term. But then it's on record for perpetuity. And so that's what people think. You know, there's Kansas, all the way from Kansas City to Kuala Lumpur, that's how to sing. Mm-hmm. And it actually happened once. I was teaching a course and the assigned, I didn't assign this, but it was the assigned song was, it was this Rihanna song, Take a Bow. Mm-hmm. You look so dumb right now. That tune.
Yep.
And they got to the bridge, and the award for the best lie goes to you. And they were singing For Making Me, and just kind of like belting it. And I said, mm-hmm. That's not what I want. I want this For Making Me. I wanted this kind of strong mix rather than this chesty belt. And they looked at me and they said, that's not how Rihanna does it.
Yeah. Yep.
And I wouldn't get off my high horse. So I went to the computer and I looked up a live version of it. And what happened was, instead of For Making Me, Rihanna went For Making Me. So she went down to a lower harmony, and her, you know, assumptively very well trained backup vocalists took the high line, sang it in their mixed registers, kicked, and the whole thing kicked ass. And that was just lucky. I, you know, it was like amazing that that all came together and that I found like at the first try an example of that. But, you know, it was one of those like, in your face, suckas. I told you to sing like this. Because most people are not chest belters, or even if they are, can only do it for a certain amount of time. That doesn't mean that there's not a healthy way to get a chest belt. There is. And, you know, if people are belters, absolutely, that's one thing they can work on. But there's a lot more, I think, to music than this one sound. And there's a lot more that can move people. You know, I listen to Tom Waits. I love Tom Waits. I don't aspire to have Tom's voice at all. People get this idea of what should be. And it takes a certain amount of maturity for somebody to sort of come out of that and go, oh, there's so many other. It's like saying, like, there's only one tone on guitar. Mm-hmm. You know, and guitars have like so many plugins and bajillions of pedals. To make all these different sounds. And if they're just going for this one because it's what their favorite guitarist plays like, you know, I just want to sound like the Edge. Like, that's cool, but then you're just going to sound like the Edge. Like, sound like you. So I think it takes a little bit of sort of prodding and poking and convincing eventually for people to kind of come around to it. But eventually people do, either because they're smart and they can see what I'm talking about or what another voice teacher is talking about, or because unfortunately often people injure themselves and then find a voice teacher who knows what they're doing and says and go, hey, teach me how to do this right. I was just imitating Adele for the last 5 years. So yeah, I mean, I think eventually most people come around to that. I think a lot of it is probably due to the fact that there have been so many people in the spotlight lately who have made vocal injury seem a little bit less terrible or less stigmatized. Adele is one. John Mayer is another. Who else? Sam Smith have had voice problems, you know, some of whom are because of things using poor technique, and some are just what happens when you sing on your chords every night all the time. And I think we don't think of ourselves and our voices as athletes. You know, you wouldn't expect somebody working at the top of their game as a football player to never have an injury. You would expect them to have an injury or to occasionally pull something and need help or need a surgery. The hope is that our technique is so good as vocalists that doesn't happen. But, you know, every once in a while, you cough the wrong way and hemorrhage a vocal cord. Like, wow. That's not, you know, you hope that doesn't happen. And you take all precautions so that it doesn't happen, but it happens. I heard about somebody sneezing and hemorrhaging a cord. So yeah, I mean, if we think of ourselves as vocal athletes who need to take real care of our instrument, I think that translates a little better into an understanding of how to use it.
Speaking of technique, let's talk about your app, which I'm so excited about because this is just such an amazing innovation. So tell us all about it.
So because I'm a teacher and I find, you know, we've talked all about work ethic and working hard. And that's how I think anyway. And I think very often people are convinced that, well, what I should say, just to go back to the idol and the voice thing, I think sometimes that those shows can give people an idea of you either have a good voice or you don't. What they don't show most of the time is how hard people have to work to get on the show. You know, they show a little bit in the interviews and all that kind of stuff, but that doesn't make for exciting television. So I think we would never think about that or think that about a bassoon player or about a guitar player or a cellist, right? That you just are good or you're not. Obviously, you have to practice your ass off. And singers do too. And so I think the public can sort of get this idea that either you're a good singer or you're not. And what that translates to is people just not practicing enough. There are a lot of rich people in LA, and some of them come into my studio and say, can't I come to you every day? And I say no. And they look at me like I'm insane. Like, why don't I want their money? Because they need to develop a sense of self-discipline, or they're never going to have a career, much less, you know, get better quickly. So I created an app. I looked for one, basically. I've been sending, as most voice teachers do, just you take MP3s on your phone, you send them to the clients, and the clients sing along with them. And I thought there has to be a better way for this. And there were a lot of like DVD sets and stuff out there, and a lot of sort of learning stuff. This is basically an educational utility. It's called Voxercise, VOXERCISE, and it's available on iTunes and on Google Play. And basically what it is a warm-up app. So it allows you to go into the app and look for whatever it is that you're looking for. We have four packs upon initial release. Eventually we'll put out more. It's a free download, and it comes with a breathing pack and a demo. So the breathing pack has some videos talking about how to breathe. And then four packs, warm-ups, exercises, register blending, and riffs and runs. The idea is to go in that order if you're a beginner. And obviously, if you're a seasoned or professional vocalist, you can just go to whatever suits you. But so we have some really kind of basic scalar warm-ups, some arpeggios, things like that. The register blending has a lot of stuff. Literally for blending registers, so that if people have a big, what they call a break, I call it a transition actually, not a break, but rather than ooh. But if people are trying to smooth out that registral transition, they can use the register blending exercises. People are working on riffs and runs, they can use that. And it plays, it has the sheet music in front of you. You can pick your range. You can set a custom range. You can sit along with a keyboard or a voice, or you can set it in the middle so you can hear a voice along with the keyboard. And I did that basically because advanced singers, you and I probably don't need that, but kind of beginning singers have a much easier time usually matching pitch with somebody else who's singing rather than with a piano. So that's one of the features we have. And then as it plays, it also has a tuner. So if you're in tune, it'll show that you're in tune. It has a little box that says in tune, and then there's one that says sharp and one that says flat. So if you're singing under pitch, it'll show you that you are, or over pitch. If you're singing in tune, it'll show you that too. So I really tried to make it as kind of user-friendly and easy to use as possible, basically just to get people practicing more. That's how we grow, as you know. And I think people often don't have a good idea of like how we grow. It would be like if I went to a personal trainer and didn't go to the gym in between seeing times that I saw the trainer. That's ridiculous. Like, doesn't work that way. So yeah, that's why I created it. And thus far, it's been received really well, which is really exciting. I met you at the ASCAP conference, and people seemed really excited about it there. That was our first major push. We just released in February, so it hasn't been out very long. Some pretty exciting singers are using it, or I've been told anyway by friends of mine who are their vocal coaches. So that's really nice. And that's kind of it. I wanted something with an educational component along with being just a utility that you can use, you know, you can take on the road with you. And also I wanted music or, you know, the ability to get better at singing to be accessible for everyone. And this thing is free to download. It's $13.99 to get all of the packs, or you can buy individual packs for $5. I think the $13.99 one is best because it's not a subscription model. You just pay it once and then you have it forever. And that's much cheaper than going to, you know, people pay anywhere from $60 to like $300 an hour for voice teachers. So when I realized that, you know, I was accessible to a lot of people, but not to everybody, I thought that wasn't really, that just kind of wasn't okay with me. So several reasons behind why I did it. And we give a portion of our proceeds to music education nonprofits as well. So yeah, try to give back, really.
But basically the fact that this is so innovative, and the fact that like, it's technology, right? You're marrying like technology with music. You're taking a different path to make income in music. Like, I just think that that's so amazing. You know what I mean? Because I think especially with the music landscape the way it is, and markets and traditional paths are just so saturated. And for someone like you that was like, there's a need, I see that there's a need, and there's a way for me to reach more people, why don't I look at the technology that's out there and innovate and create something that is needed and yet hasn't been developed? Like, I just think that's so phenomenal.
Thanks. I mean, we weren't actually the first to market. There are a few others. You know, I think most of them either look great and don't function super well, or function great and look terrible. So I was really out to kind of up the game on that. We weren't first to market, but I do think that we're the most comprehensive. And I really based it off of, I was in class at Berkeley with a wonderful bass player named Massimo Biolcatti, who invented the iRealB or the iReal Pro app, which for jazz musicians is this indispensable app that has every jazz standard in it and allows you with a touch of a button to play along with instruments or to change the key, transpose the song while you're on the gig. It's a really wonderful utility. And I thought, you know, somebody needs to do that for the voice. So that was, you know, that was, yeah, that was the hope. And I think we've gotten there. People seem to think so. So it's exciting.
Yeah. And again, it's a way for you, you know, to expand your brand, to expand your reach. And that's the thing. I think that that's sort of the common theme that's been really interesting with my guests on this podcast is about, like, look, you have to innovate. You have to be a marketer. You can't just be, it would be so great if we could be in the Renaissance times and just be like the artist, you know, that can like go off somewhere. But we,
probably had benefactors like,
exactly. Right. And nowadays it's like, if you're truly the DIY indie artist, you have to figure out ways that, you know, how you can earn.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think people very often, like as songwriters, will be like, I'm a great songwriter, and they'll go and they'll play Hotel Cafe, like great songwriters do. And it's like, they've made it. And, you know, how much do you make by the end of the gig once you've paid your band? It's much more about, like, can I get syncs? Can I use what it is that I do to not only be broadcast to other people and share with the world, but also, like, make me a living? Some people can do that through touring, but I think most people I know who are successful have done that through production or syncs, you know, getting their music on TV shows. Some people start by doing that and then get into composition and start writing for TV or film. So there's a lot out there. It's just a matter of harnessing it. And somebody would have made this app if I hadn't. So why the fuck not? You know, it's interesting because this was made for people who sing contemporary music. It's useful even for classical singers. They don't have to turn the voice off and just sing along with the piano. But it's been really well embraced by contemporary singers and teachers. They're really excited about it. It's interesting to me that in the classical world, which isn't my world, but even so, you know, people are really sort of wary of it. And while I understand that, certainly this is not meant to replace a voice teacher. You have to make sure you have good technique and you're using it well. You know, I think if you don't innovate, you'll die. Somebody else will innovate and the art will, you know, it'll just wither away. So there had to be this break from the norm. And everybody's doing it. It's not like I'm such a genius at all. It's like there's an app for everything. You know, I don't have a metronome anymore because I use the Tempo app. So people use guitar tuners on their phones. Like they don't even need to have guitar tuners anymore. All sorts of stuff that, like, I think it's like sort of the idea of disruption. Because if you don't do it, somebody else will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not only that, now you're making it a more, you know, level playing field for those that don't have the means, for those that are making minimum wage and don't live in LA and have a good voice, but don't, you know, can't afford to go to school for voice or learn technique. And now here's this incredible app.
Yeah, totally. You know, $100 an hour for a voice lesson to somebody who works at McDonald's could be what they make all day. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can't, that's a luxury that most people I think can't afford. So yeah, I mean, certainly it's not meant to replace voice teachers, but really kind of get people headed in the right direction. You know, you could take a few lessons and then go, okay, now I can see how much I have to practice along with the app, and then eventually go back and say, you know, what do I work on now? Rather than I have to go here every week and kill myself, trying to pay for it.
Well, and again, it's like, it could be your app versus like going on YouTube and trying to sing like Rihanna, you know, right. Like that's maybe you're the stopgap now for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and there are certain, you know, there are a lot of great educators on YouTube. There are also a lot of like fucking totally shitty ones. Mm-hmm. And I think because there's no governing body of voice teachers saying, like, you can teach and you can't, like there is for doctors and lawyers, that's pretty hard for people to weed out. So I wanted to make something that was, you know, made by a reputable voice teacher.
Yep.
Who has some educational content so that they can learn, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, brilliant. Sarah, you're so amazing. And I'm so grateful that you could come on the show today and share all this amazing knowledge. So how do people get a hold of you? How do people find you?
So, yeah, if they want to take lessons with me at the studio, it's my website's just www.voicestudioLA.com. I'm also pretty easily Googleable. Sarah Leib is my name, S-A-R-A-L-E-I-B. So there are links to all my teaching from my music website and stuff. Yeah, and if people are just interested in downloading the app and seeing how it works, just go to Voxercise, VOXERCISE.com. You can go there and download for either iTunes or Google Play platform, so iTunes or Android, or just Google it or put it into the iTunes store, really the App Store, and you should be able to find it. So yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. My studio is right in Mid Wilshire, right near Pico and Fairfax.
Do you ever do online?
I do Skype lessons. Looking into actually this. Another sort of wonderfully entrepreneurial voicelessons.com has been emailing me a lot saying, hey, we've solved the problem with audio lag. So I got to check them out and see if they actually have. Because, of course, you know, if clients are on the road, or I have this one client who lives in Australia, it's great teaching, but it's never quite as good as in person. So I have to check that out and see if it's as good. But, yeah, totally. Teach online.
Yeah, we'll just continue your worldwide domination. I'm all for it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was really nice to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wasn't that fantastic? I'm so glad that we had Sarah on the show to talk all about her career and about vocal training and about this incredible app, Voxercise. So again, you can find Sarah at saraleib.com, S-A-R-A-L-E-I-B.com, and her app is called Voxercise, V-O-X-E-R-C-I-S-E. So go on and download that sucker. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? We're all about the movers and shakers and innovators in the music biz, all finding out exactly how they did indeed get that music job. We're at musicjobspodcast.com, musicjobswithanspodcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Last.fm, and more. I am your host, L. Ariel. I have an EP coming out, and I finally have a drop date for it. So it's June 8th, Friday, June 8th. Save the date, June 8th. Save the date, June 8th. It's called Diatribe, and it's a collaboration with the incredible record producer and songwriter Sound Control. So you can follow me at lariel music.com or follow me on Twitter, Instagram at lariel music, and I will keep you posted on updates all about the EP, and I sure hope you will check it out when it drops. Okay, people, have a wonderful, wonderful week, and I can't wait to chat with all of you again. So in the meantime, take good care, and remember to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't give up.